Can simply believing that a drug works actually help in the healing process? Harvard researchers are studying the power of the placebo. They even have a program in placebo studies, trying to figure out, should placebos play a bigger role in patient care in the future? We'll talk about it. Plus, is it right for the government to ask scientists to not publish important elements of their research if it might help terrorists learn how to create a potentially deadly virus? Scientists are divided over the government's request that scientific journals leave out key data from two bird flu studies. We'll get into that debate. And our video pick, levitating fruit flies, strawberries, perhaps even bodies. All coming up after the break, so stay with us. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. It's a story we've heard before. A doctor prescribes a fake pill to a patient after other medications have failed. The patient begins to feel better after taking what she thinks is a real drug, but is only a placebo. The story is not fictitious. It's rooted in real data. One study estimates 50% of U.S. physicians who believe in the benefits of placebos and the placebo effect secretly give dummy pills to unsuspecting patients. The ethical questionable practice led researchers at Harvard University to explore whether the power of placebos can be harnessed honestly. And what they found was that the placebos work even when patients are in on the secret that it is a sham treatment. They know that they're taking a placebo, and it still works. Ted Kapchuk is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Med School, director of the program in placebo studies, and the therapeutic encounter at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. The program was created last summer and is wholly dedicated to the study of placebos. He joins us from Cambridge, Mass. Welcome to Science Friday.
Ira, thanks for inviting me.
How do you define a placebo?
Well, a placebo is a sugar pill or inert substance that's used to hide the genuine treatment in a clinical trial. A placebo effect is the effect of a sugar pill. The problem with that common definition is that it's an oxymoron. An inert pill can't have an effect. So what our team says is that the placebo is also hiding a very important phenomena, the clinical encounter. We think the placebo effect and is the a surrogate marker or a way of measuring the effect of just caring for a person, with the act of caring for a person. We think that it's the placebo is about the words, the gestures, eye contact, warmth, empathy, compassion that a physician exchanges with a patient, a doctor-patient relationship. We think the placebo is about medical symbols, white coats, diplomas, prescription pads. We think the placebo is about medical rituals, the ritual procedures in medicine, waiting, talking, disrobing, being examined and then being treated by pills or surgery. Ultimately, we think the placebo is about the power of the imagination, trust, and hope in the medical encounter.
Can you quantify any of this?
Well, that's what my work is, and that's what my our program at the Beth Israel Deaconess and Harvard Medical School is trying to do, is that this is usually considered the art of medicine. It's in the background. People are mostly concerned about drugs, procedures, and surgery, and our job is to quantify what's been hidden in the background and move it to the foreground to make the human aspects of healthcare more prominent and optimize them once we understand what they can do and how they work.
Because we hear that the placebo effect works about 30% of the time, correct?
No, that's more of a medical myth. Sometimes sugar pills will not shrink a tumor, will not lower cholesterol, don't lower hypertension. Placebo effects work in some conditions much better than others. Placebo's treatments will work in things like pain, insomnia, depression, anxiety, functional bowel disorders, functional urinary disorders. So that 30% is really a myth that was created a long time ago.
And you've discovered, let me see if this is correct, that even when the patients know they're taking a placebo, it still works.
Well, discovery is a big word. What we did was we randomized patients with irritable bowel syndrome. half of whom went, we gave them placebos. We told them it was placebos. The bottle said there were placebos. We told them that the study was about placebos. This was an inert pill they were taking. And half of them we randomized to a no treatment control, wait list, to see, to make sure that if they changed and got better, it wasn't the normal natural waxing and waning of diseases or spontaneous remission. And we found after 3 weeks that people who were taking placebos did much better than those in the comparison group. Our study was small. It needs to be replicated. It's more proof of principle, but it certainly changes the conventional wisdom, which was if you know you're taking a placebo, you're not going to get better. And what I think many other teams have to replicate this in other diseases, and we hope that that will happen down the line.
But you're saying, if I heard you correctly, just to go back on your original statement, is that the placebo basically masks, or it's really the encounter with the doctor and all the trappings of the office and the being taken care of that does, that is the action that it actually is helping the patient and making that patient feel better.
I think that's what I meant to say. I'm glad you said it that way. Yeah, the sugar pill doesn't do anything. What does something is the context of healing. It's the rituals healing. It's the it's being in a healing relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's what we study. But the placebo pill is a wonderful tool, or a saline injection is a wonderful tool to isolate what is usually in the background, take it away from the medications and procedures that medicine does, and actually study just the act of caring. That's, I think, what we're measuring when we study placebo effects.
And how did you get involved in this and Harvard opening up this center?
I was originally hired at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Harvard Medical School in 1990 to help do research in Asian medicine. And when I got there, my original training was in Asia. They talked about we have to find out whether this intervention, be it acupuncture, herbs, or other kinds of alternate therapies, is more than placebo. And I would ask, so what does it mean that it's more than placebo? And they say, well, it's more than placebo. And I have a background in civil rights when I was a young person. And I said, boy, they're treating this placebo effect like it's really some kind of disgusting phenomena. And what is it exactly? So I'd ask. And I realized there wasn't a lot known. And I thought this would be a better way of doing my career. Luckily, at that time, the NIH created a National Center for Complementary and Alternate Medicine, which has a deep interest in investigating the placebo effect. And I've been able to receive funding for many, many experiments, which hopefully have contributed to understanding this phenomenon better.
Mm-hmm. One criticism of giving patients placebos is that it's unethical and involves deception.
Anytime one deceives a patient, in my opinion, it is unethical. The clear standard of ethics is transparency, respect for person, informed consent. The only time you're able to do deception is if a patient agrees in a randomized controlled trial that things will be concealed. So my job is to think of ethical ways of optimizing the different aspects of the therapeutic encounter so that we can use placebo effects ethically. A second way my job is to try to figure out, is there a way of using sugar pills in situations where we really don't have good therapies, where the sugar pill may be valuable? Mm-hmm. A third aspect of my job is to figure out ways of lowering placebo effects, because one of the problems for drug development is that sometimes the drug may be effective, but it competes with the placebo effect, and it's very hard to detect the difference. So those are my three jobs that I think I'm doing.
Mm-hmm. You had some interesting findings of an asthma study that you did.
Yeah, our asthma study was published in New England Journal this summer. It was funded by NCAM at the NIH, and it was actually came out different than we expected. We bought time from asthma patients, 40 patients, and we brought them in, and we took them off their medication 12 different times. And we brought them in every few days at one session, and on different times we gave them an active bronchial dilator, albuterol, which is an effective drug for relieving asthma. Three times we gave them fake inhalator, three times we gave them fake acupuncture, and three times we gave them no treatment, just sitting and doing nothing. Because sometimes people get better by just sitting and doing nothing. We want to make sure that it's the placebo that's doing something, not just sitting and waiting. And we had a very interesting finding that actually we didn't expect. we found that when we looked at objective measures, the amount of air that's pushed out of the lungs in 1 second, we found that the real medication was showed a great improvement. The two placebos, the placebo inhalator, the placebo acupuncture, had a little bit of improvement, and the sitting there and doing nothing had a little bit of improvement. There actually was no placebo effect at all on an objective measure on the pathophysiology of asthma. But then my asthma colleagues said, oh my God, this whole experiment didn't work. And I said, someone get the statistician to get the subjective outcomes. How did people feel? And when they crunched the numbers while we were waiting, it turned out that when you asked the patient how much did they feel relief from their asthma, their subjective experience, their own personal sensation, the real medication was very effective, the fake inhalator was very effective, and the fake acupuncture was very effective, and just sitting there for 2.5 hours was very, very little. And what we found is that on subjective, person-centered, how one feels, there was no drug effect because the drug was no different than the two placebos. And we inferred to this, at least in this situation, that the placebo effect is mainly about how we experience things, symptoms, complaints, how we react to the underlying pathology. Whether this applies across the board, I think, is too early to say. But I think it can say, at least in this experiment, it looks like the placebo is about the experiences that patients have, not necessarily about the underlying pathology.
Yeah.
But obviously more research.
Yeah, you didn't prevent the underlying pathology from working, but
right.
The patients didn't mind as much.
They felt as good as taking the drug. Yeah.
Yeah. They felt as good as taking the drug.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Is there any message here for doctors? And we've got about a minute left. Any message?
Well, I think the bottom message is that drugs are real important, but also just taking care of people and the act of compassion, taking care, the act of trust is really critical. And with lots of experiments that show that that potentiates the effects of very powerful drugs. The bottom line is, low-tech placebo may have something to contribute to high-tech procedures, surgery, and medicine.
And be much cheaper.
Hopefully.
Of course, you have to spend time with the patient, too, which is another story in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, a skilled physician, if you know how to ask, how's your aunt doing? That's a major, major thing that takes a minute. Or how's that problem at work going? Besides asking about the urination or the pain is.
Interesting. Thank you, Ted.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Ted Kapchuk is an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Med School and director of the program in placebo studies and the therapeutic encounter at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Hi, SciFri fans. There's a new app in town. If you're listening to this on our SciFri iPhone or iPad app, there's a newer, better app waiting for you to download on iTunes, the SciFri Booster Edition. It's loaded with new features like playlists, Twitter, Facebook, and other goodies. It's optimized for your iPad. The videos look terrific. An Android app is in the works, too, so please be patient. For you iOS fans, just go to the iTunes Store and search for the SciFri BE app. That's the SciFri BE app. Download and enjoy. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Our next story is about ferrets, those furry little animals that some people keep as pets, but which some scientists use as guinea pigs, and that's the story that interests us, because experiments using ferrets to study how the bird flu spreads has caused quite a commotion in the world of science. Two labs, one in the Netherlands and the other in Wisconsin, say they have developed a deadly strain of bird flu virus that can be transmitted through the air from ferret to ferret, something that couldn't happen easily before. A federal advisory board has urged the journals Science and Nature not to publish all the details of the research. Members of the advisory board and some biosecurity experts are concerned that the research could fall into the wrong hands. Other researchers disagree, and they call the studies too valuable not to share with the scientific community. So we're going to talk about that this hour. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Sort of have a debate between two sides of the issues. And let me introduce my guests. Dr. D.A. Henderson is professor of public health and medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. He's also a distinguished scholar at the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. He led the successful worldwide effort to eradicate smallpox in the 70s and directed the U.S. Office of Public Health Emergency Preparedness after the deadly anthrax letter attacks. He joins us from WYPR in Baltimore. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Henderson.
Very happy to be with you.
Thank you. Dr. Vincent Racaniello is a professor of microbiology and immunology at Columbia, and he is here in our New York bureau. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for pronouncing the name right.
Well, we try pronounce them so badly so many times that even my own name gets wrong. Let me begin with you, Dr. Racaniello. What do we know about this virus developed by the two labs?
So we know little because it hasn't been published. That's important to point out at the outset. What we know is what we've heard through stories, and that is that the scientists in the Netherlands took an avian H5N1 influenza virus strain, which is lethal in ferrets but is not transmitted, and they passed it from ferret to ferret until they obtained an isolate that could then be transported through the air from one ferret to another, from a ferret in one cage to an uninfected ferret in another. Mm-hmm. And then they identified the genetic changes that occur to accompany that process.
Mm-hmm. And you say that we don't know that much about it because stuff has been held back.
That's right.
What has been held back?
So the methods, how exactly they pass the virus from ferret to ferret, what types of ferret, how many ferrets, how much virus they put in, and most importantly, the genetic changes that occurred when the virus was able to pass from one ferret to the other.
And why would you need to know those things?
So we don't understand why the H5N1 viruses do not transmit among people. And this kind of experiment gets at that. Why are the virus is not able to be transmitted? We can't do that experiment in people, obviously, so we use an animal model, which is the ferret.
Dr. Henderson, you believe it was the correct call to hold back that data?
I do believe it was. No question about it.
Tell us
why. I think
we're
dealing here with a very serious organism, which, if indeed it did spread well among people and killed as many people as it has to date, occurring as individual cases or small groups of cases, and that is a death rate of more than 50%, we would have a real disaster in our hands. So how this organism spreads is important, but once it is the information is made widely available, I think the fear is that this will be a point of experiment for a number of people, and we have to worry about an accident in a laboratory, a release, escape by some means.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Racaniello?
So this is a common misconception about H5N1 avian influenza, that it's highly lethal. The number of 50% lethality is quoted widely. What that means is half of the 600 people who have been admitted to hospitals die, but we don't know how many people have been infected, and there is some good evidence that many more people haven't been infected without being sick. And so that would make the virus much less scary than everyone thinks it is.
Dr. Henderson,
well, wait.
Go
with
ahead.
All, with
go
all,
respond. I'm giving you a chance. Go ahead.
Okay. With all deference to Dr. Racaniello, there is one study that was done in Thailand, just recently reported, in which it appeared that 9% of the population did carry antibody against the H5N1. However, since back in 2003, there have been many studies done of patients and the individuals in their family, in their village, contacts in hospitals, and so forth. The transmission rate is extremely low. We're looking at one or two cases. And thus we're seeing, counting the cases that way, and these are more than 20 studies, you would see that the death rate was right around 50%. And that seems to hold up from the small outbreak to small outbreak. The study in Thailand is a distinct exception to anything that's been seen.
There have been about 17 or 18 such studies done, starting in the late 1990s when these viruses first infected people, up to the present, and there are a handful that show seropositivity in certain populations. I think we need to go into rural Asian populations that have contact with poultry and really get at this. Before we do that, we can't say that this virus is 50% lethal.
Dr. Henderson, if there is so much concern on your part and the part of others about the outcome of this research, why was this study given the go-ahead to begin with, if it might have turned out this way?
Well, I think decisions with regard to research are usually in the hands of the investigators and their institutions. Very rarely is there any imposition on the part of government with regard to what one does or doesn't do with the viruses. However, I think it's important to point out that there is precedent for a group of scientists to get together and, working with government, impose restrictions on the use of a virus which was highly lethal and would have an enormous effect if it was got into the population. And that pertains to smallpox virus, which carries a case fatality rate, death rate, of about 30%. Most of the population in the world now, roughly 75%, are fully susceptible to it. We don't really have enough vaccine to control it. And the concern was that if it got out, began to spread, we'd have a hard job controlling it. It was felt to be serious enough that it was decided that only two laboratories would be allowed to work with the virus. And those two laboratories, one was in Moscow, one in Atlanta, two laboratories with a history of working with it. And secondly, that any protocols that they wished to implement, studies, would have to pass muster with an international group of scientists in regard to the need for doing it and risk and so forth. Both are working in high security laboratories. Now, that provision has been in place for really more than 10 years, and it is still being adhered to today. Now, this is not to suggest that H5N1 would be handled in the same way. There are different conditions here. But what has been established is a precedent where there are a group of scientists and governments who decide that this is too serious a virus or organism to be circulating, and we should keep this under the closest of supervision.
Dr. Akinyola?
It's clear in this post-9/11, post-anthrax situation that we need to regulate in some way experiments that are perceived as dangerous. You have to always balance the danger imposed by an experiment versus restricting publication. Science works best when information is freely exchanged. In my view, the science in this case does not support the view that this is a dangerous experiment to release information about. It's not the one to set the precedent going forward.
I recall back in 1974 when genetic engineering was in its infancy and the tools were being developed, there was the Asilomar conference. I'm sure you're shaking
Correct.
Your head. You remember.
Correct.
And scientists got together to discuss whether this new world, brave new world of genetic engineering would creep out of the laboratory uncontrollably, and they voluntarily stopped their research while they had this discussion. Would something like that be workable in this situation?
So I started my work with recombinant DNA just at that time. I remember it well. And many scientists got together and said, wait, this may be dangerous. Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. Far more scientists than are on the NSABB, for example, the board that is intervening in the H5N1 studies. So I think this would be a great idea to talk about science, to get a very wide community of scientists together and talk about what are the dangers, what kinds of experiments do we have to restrict, and which do we have to restrict publication of. I don't think this is the example to set the precedent for that.
No. Dr. Henderson?
I would be supportive of this with one exception. I don't see this at this point being a time to look at possibility of working with any virus in under any circumstances. I think the smallpox virus situation is what we call an outlier, an extreme situation. In the case of the H5N1, As I say, I think we have a difference of opinion on what the case fatality rate is, but it certainly looks to me, from the 20 or so studies been done, that it's about 50%. It has now been demonstrated to be able to be transmitted from ferret to ferret. There's a belief that that may have application in humans, that it could be transmitted from human to human by aerosol. If we had a release of this mutant virus into the air and it was able to be transmitted, as appears it can be transmitted at least to some degree, we, I think, are taking a real risk. Were it to escape, I don't see any way by which you can control it. We could control smallpox. If a smallpox escaped from a laboratory, we have the vaccine, we could control it. So it poses less of a threat in terms of transmission and less of a case fatality rate than does H5N1. But H5N1 is on the outer limits of this spectrum. And the question is, are we willing to go through experiments to make the virus, mutant virus, available to a number of different laboratories to risk the possible escape from the laboratory of that virus? Or are we going to control it much more severely and hold the data and maybe have the discussion, but keep the discussion focused on an agent which potentially is now, I think many agree, potentially a catastrophic virus?
I think there is no reason to assume that this virus will transmit among humans based on the ferret experiments. Ferrets have been shown to be wrong over and over. The 2009 swine origin virus, when it first emerged, was put into ferrets. It was highly lethal and deadly. Everyone warned that this would be a bad virus. It turned out to be milder than we think. So I think that that's not a good argument to use. If we are really worried about H5N1 spreading, and I think it's been around a long enough time, it's infected enough people to be able to acquire that capability. If we're really worried, we should stockpile antivirals, which are known to inhibit viral replication, and perhaps even a vaccine.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking in a debate about whether some research with ferrets and the spread of bird flu among them should be totally released into journals, Science and Nature. My guests are Dr. D.A. Henderson, Dr. Vincent Racaniello. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Some questions coming in on Twitter. You can also tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. The brown word wants to know how much of this info has already been sort of WikiLeaked, published on the internet. That how much could a scientist guess about what has happened?
Well, we know that if you pass the virus in ferrets, you can make a transmissible form, and that's a relatively easy experiment to do. So that's out, and the next step to knowing the sequence is really easily obtained.
So that you're saying that hiding the details really doesn't matter?
That's right. I don't think it's of any effect at all.
Dr. Henderson?
Well, I think the virus that has been involved here with the transmission experiments, we do not know what the genetic character of it is. We can suppose that we have not some knowledge of it, but we don't know this for sure, and I'm sure this will be in the paper. I think there are other factors on this that I would think we would do better at this time to say stop and let's talk about it. And let's not plunge on. Meanwhile, what I think we ought to be doing is developing a much larger capacity to produce influenza vaccine than we now have, which we need anyway for in with other pandemics, which we know we can expect, and that we look to advance the science in the vaccine technology so that we have a vaccine that is more broadly protective and for a longer period of time. And we could put a good deal of money into that and a good deal of scientific work and I think have something which would be of value irrespective of whether it is needed for H5N1. It is needed generally for other vaccine strains.
You know, we are in our 21st year of Science Friday. Every single year, I could take Dr. Henderson, I could take your statement and play it going back 20 years. We need to develop an alternative method of making vaccines, yada, yada, yada. And we should do something. And it hasn't, you know, just something every. It's always 30 years away, like nuclear fusion or something. It's developing a new way to make these vaccines.
It's being worked on. There are very promising alternative vaccines, for example, made in plants.
Right.
And within 5 years, the clinical trials with those will be done, and they can be made very rapidly within weeks of a new virus emerging. So I think it's going to be less than 20 or 30 years.
Do you agree, Dr. Henderson?
I do indeed, and I would say even now we're producing influenza vaccine in tissue cell culture rather than in eggs. We see ways by which it could be the antigenicity can be broadened, and I think we can get a much better vaccine. We're already on the way, but we have not addressed this as a serious matter, that is, to really move ahead on it. And I can say that with some feeling, because it was 2006 that we made a strong pitch to put more money into vaccine production. $200 million was made available to some four different laboratories. That was later raised to $2 billion to speed the process along. The product has not been outstanding. There could be a lot more done, and I think we need to press on.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to take a break, come back, and continue the debate, your discussions. Your questions are welcome. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry. Also go to our Facebook page at SciFry and our website at sciencefriday.com. Talking with Dr. Vincent Racaniello and Dr. D.A. Henderson. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about two bird flu studies that may not be published in the fall to security concerns. Talking with Dr. Vincent Racaniello, professor of microbiology and immunology at Columbia University, and Dr. D.A. Henderson, professor of public health and medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. Lots of let me just get this, bring us up to date. What is the status of those studies? Are they being just held up? The detail?
Well, my understanding is the journals are negotiating with the NSABB to determine exactly how the papers will be phrased.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Raul in Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, Raul.
Hi. So I had a question regarding releasing the details of the study. So Science says that it wants this information to be open and that perhaps specific details of the study should be distributed within a particular group of approved scientists. But how exactly do you create those guidelines for who is an approved scientist? How do you evaluate who is trustworthy? Does someone coming from an academic institution such as Duke or Harvard, does that just immediately make them eligible to receive information? Is there some sort of test that we have to give to ensure that the people who receive this information are trustworthy? How do you create those guidelines and evaluate who can receive this information?
Dr. Henderson, you want to tackle that?
Sorry, what?
Well, I think that is a real problem. And I think the more that this information is disseminated even a small, whatever arbitrarily limited group is there, there's going to be, it's a challenge, and more people are going to be involved in experimenting. And I think there's no question about it. Scientists are curious people, and this is set out as a real challenge. I think what is needed is for the science community to be fully educated as to what the real risk is here. If the real risk is, as I perceive it, and I know a number of my colleagues do, this is a virus that we shouldn't really be experimenting with, even except under the most rigid circumstances of safety. Sort of one mistake in one laboratory and one escape, with the pace that influenza normally spreads, you don't have a chance of stopping it. And we've looked at this again and again. I've been involved with the most recent epidemic, 2007, back in 1957. We tried to stop or contain outbreaks of influenza, and it was just impossible. It was beyond you before you could really do anything about it.
Dr. Racaniello?
I fully appreciate the need for virologists to be educated about biosecurity. And I also would like the biosecurity specialists to be educated about the science underpinning our views on this. And again, the science says that this is not a large threat. The use of ferrets, the natural course of the disease not being transmissible, the wrong case fatality ratio, all of this is something you need to consider beyond just worrying about someone nefarious getting hold of this information.
So here you're saying there's a dispute between microbiologists who actually work with the viruses and epidemiologists who study the spreads of diseases? Is there a disconnect, you're saying?
So I have talked with many influenza virologists about that, and they are to the number all in favor of releasing this information. The caution is being raised by epidemiologists and biosecurity experts, which is, of course, their job to do so. So there is some kind of disconnect, and they have to get together and talk about this.
Good. Dr. Henderson, do you think you could modify your views a bit if you spoke more with them, or are you pretty set in the way you believe?
Well, it sounds to me like maybe Dr. Rockinello is pretty set in the way of things he believes in this case, and I think we're looking at it, yes, in different ways, but I think there are a number of virologists who are fully in accord with what I've been talking about, and there are a number of virologists who have been very supportive of the restrictions that have been imposed on smallpox. At the same time, I think there is a concern here, and the public health concern, ultimately, that is our concern, the health of the public. And what is worrisome is not necessarily that you have somebody with malicious intent, but that you have an experiment done and in which, in all good faith, proper measures are taken and an escape occurs. This has happened before. It will happen again. And so that at this point in time, I think Dr. Rockinello is right. I think what we do is stop where we are right now. And we have that dialogue, or we had that discussion about the among the people concerned as to where we go from here. But meanwhile, I would say I don't think it would be wise to publish it. And I would say let's have the discussion, as he suggests.
How quickly could, if you've now decoded the virus, how quickly can you make a vaccine for it in advance of any other research that you might?
Well, if you make an egg-based vaccine, it takes you 6 months. Minimum to do that. But the other vaccines, which would be quicker, the plant-based ones I mentioned, they're faster, but they're still experimental. So it's still a long time, and we're always behind the curve when a pandemic emerges. We're always very late in hitting that first outbreak with vaccine.
How long did it take for this vaccine to mutate itself, the virus to mutate between the ferrets going back and forth?
Well, according to what we've read in science, it took 10 ferret-to-ferret passes. So you infect a ferret, you harvest what the ferret makes, you infect another ferret, you do that 10 times.
So you manually have to do the infection, and by the 10th time, they were infecting each other.
By the 10th time, the virus that you got from that 10th ferret, if you then infected a ferret in one cage, that ferret would infect an uninfected animal in a separate cage.
Mm-hmm. And ferrets have generally been used as models for humans.
Yes, for influenza, they are very good models because they do a lot of the things that we do when we get flu. They sneeze and cough and get a fever and so forth.
So then what is wrong with Dr. Henderson's reasoning here? If they can, ferrets can pass it easily between them, the two of them, and they're good models for humans, why are they not good models for human-to-human transmission?
Well, the key there is the word model. It doesn't tell you everything that you want to know about human infection. As I referred to earlier, there are many occasions where a virus that does X in people doesn't do the same thing in ferrets. Plus, we have this long experience with human infection with H5N1, and it simply has not transmitted, except it infects people that have contact with sick birds, for example. So I think all of that information argues against that virus being able to transmit in people.
On the other hand, do you think your microbiologist might stop, as Dr. Henderson says, he might think about and have a conversation first about?
This is a good idea. I think instead of publishing a watered-down version of this paper, just stop, don't publish anything, and have this discussion. That would be fine. I think it's a travesty to publish a paper which doesn't allow anyone else to reproduce the results.
Mm-hmm. And you'd go for that too, Dr. Henderson.
Well, I think, yes, I think this makes sense, but I think it's a little more than passage from ferret to ferret. If I understand the studies that were done, there was one set of passages which it became more transmissible. There was another passage was not successful. One would might assume that there are differences between the two viruses that emerged and the differences between the virus that we're looking at with regard to the virus that that caused the transmission and its beginning apparent. These are studies that and information is needed. I think it's not quite so simple as just passing it from ferret to ferret, and anybody's likely to do it. I think that there's some other problems here, and I think we need to have a hard look, and I think you've got to have some sort of group has to look at it. If you can't make a huge group looking at it and handling it, what you're looking at is a small group making some decisions. But I think the penalty we pay if we make a mistake could be very high indeed.
But then again, you have no concrete suggestion of how to choose that group of people.
It's going to have to be arbitrarily selected. There's no doubt about it. There's no other way to do it.
Yeah. All right, we're going to have to leave. This is quite interesting. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us. Maybe we found some common ground here, and maybe there will be something somewhere in between where you folks will get together and come up with a solution. D.A. Henderson is professor of public health and medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, also a distinguished scholar at the Center for Biosecurity at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And Dr. Vincent Racaniello is professor of microbiology and immunology at Columbia University here in New York. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank
you. For taking time to be with us.
Thank you. Have
a Happy New Year. Flora Lichtman is here with our video pick of the week. Happy New Year to you, Flora.
Happy New Year, Ira.
You got a good first of the year video for us.
Yeah, I think so. The question is, what happens when you levitate fruit flies? This is a question that Richard Hill, a physicist at the University of Nottingham, was wondering and executed in his lab. Can you imagine what would happen?
Is it like a trick? Levitating?
I know. How do you do that?
I mean, you put a hoop around them to show there's nothing holding them up?
Actually, the technology of this is kind of the part that I liked the most. Yeah. It turns out, Richard Hill says, that we are all a tiny bit magnetic, just a really itsy-bitsy bit. And anything with electrons is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a repulsive force. So if we interact with a magnetic field, we're sort of very slightly repelled by it. We're a little bit repulsive. But
speak for yourself.
Yeah, just I will. I am a little bit repulsive.
I'm a lot repulsive, so I'd really be levitating. But go ahead.
Right. So if you have a very powerful magnet, mm-hmm. you can feel this force. And that's what they have. They have a superconducting solenoid magnet at the University of Nottingham, which is basically a lot of wire coiled up mm-hmm. with a ton of amps running through it.
Super cold, right? Super
and liquid helium to keep it cold.
Yeah.
So this produces a big magnetic field, big enough so that this slight repulsion that all objects feel can be used to push them into the air and levitated. So they have all this footage of strawberries levitating, liquids levitating, and in this latest study, they looked at fruit flies to see if their behavior changed in a no-gravity situation.
So levitating in the air, they considered to be like no gravity. They were just floating in the air?
Yeah, so it's the magnetic force is counteracting the force of gravity, and they're floating there, but, you know, they're in these little petri dishes,
right.
So it's a little bit disappointing to me anyway, because I wanted to see them, like, floating all over the place, but they're mostly walking.
Mm-hmm.
But it turns out that they change their walking speed a lot. They, like, start zipping around. And there's another place you can put them in this magnet where they feel 2G, like double gravity, and they become couch potatoes. They just don't move at all.
Must be pretty heavy, you know, feeling of heavy weight.
Double fruit flies. Yeah, it'd be like walking the two of you.
This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Flora Lichtman about levitating fruit flies.
And other things.
And so you have the video up on our website at sciencefriday.com. There is the video of the levitating, not just the fruit flies, but
the water droplets. And the strawberry is my personal favorite. And actually, Richard Hill told me this great story when he levitated. He wanted to levitate beer for scientific reasons,
obviously.
Of course. Here's, the question was, what happens to the bubbles in beer when you levitate it? Because the bubbles apparently need a surface to nucleate on.
Right.
So where do they go? So if you put beer in your superconducting magnet, I can't even believe he did this. It's like a $700,000 piece of equipment.
It was New Year's.
but it's documented on his website. And he then, so he puts it in and you don't see any bubbles, which he's filmed with his camera that he stripped all the metal out of, by
of
the
course.
Way, because it's the magnet problem. And he bends over and sticks a straw into it and verifies that the bubbles are there. They're just not nucleated. So the gas is there. It's just dissolved in the in the beer because there's no glass. So that's what it would be like to drink beer in space, if you've been wondering.
Wow. I'm sure he wants more money for this. Beer experiment.
Well, he said this is a problem for astronauts because the bubbles don't go up in space. You know, you can't burp in space.
That's right.
All these fun facts.
So if you want to see this, the beer is on the video.
The beer is in a different video, but you can see water. It looks very similar to the beer.
Water droplets, they are levitated in space. Oh, great. Houdini would love it. Mm-hmm. And the strawberry is there.
Mm-hmm.
And did he just throw fruit in there and see what else?
I mean, I think anything little would work. I asked, you know, my first question was like, well, so can you levitate me? When am I going to be levitated? And this was kind of amazing. The diamagnetic susceptibility, this is this weak repulsive force that we all have, is different when you compare bone to like soft tissue, like your skin. So if you were to levitate a person, he said it's theoretically possible, but you'd probably be levitating your soft tissue higher than your bones. So your bones would kind of drop down and your soft tissue would be holding you up, which sounds uncomfortable.
Yeah, I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, might as well just go to space at that point.
Or would your soft tissue then flip you upside down? Like, if how can I put this delicately? If you have a lot of tissue in your tushy.
What if you have a beer belly?
You go. Is that side float up, higher
Richard
than the
Hill,
other bones?
Please tell us. Hopefully we can find an answer.
Find an answer. Yeah, and this is not something you can build at home, right? Because people are going to say, I got a little bit of magnets, a little of this. That
I know,
sort
you
of thing.
Did suggest that a car battery could be used.
You said there was like 100 amps going through this, right? I was researching.
120
amps. A car battery puts that out when you start your engine
for
a very short period of time. But I don't have that superconducting.
Yeah, that might
ring
be the missing
down
component.
Just that missing part that I got to go to Radio Shack and get those pieces for so I can do this one at home.
But, yeah, we're not suggesting.
We're not suggesting anybody. If you want to see the video, it's up on our website at sciencefriday.com. Levitating all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've gone from we had stuff flying in that little tubes weeks before, and now we've got levitating stuff.
Yeah, what's next?
What's next? You can see the video at our website at sciencefriday.com. Let us know what you think. Maybe you have some suggestions, or you've got a video of your own you want to send along as a companion to that one. Thank
you, Flora. Absolutely. Thanks, Ira.
Our program's senior producer is Annette Heist. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Taliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.